This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Northwest Indiana tourism and hospitality industries are predicting a stronger financial picture this summer with more amateur sporting events, festivals, and other events that can take place with the gradual lifting of the restrictions caused by the pandemic. Sparrow Spottistatos, the president of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority, joined us for an update.
Well, you know, Chris, one, thank you for having me. It's been a while. It's good to see you.
Yeah.
It's nice to be able to sit across the table and do an interview. You know, we had it a lot better off than a lot of Indiana communities. We only lost about 27% of our business in 2020. Mm-hmm. And you compare that with other cities and towns, Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, Evansville, Bloomington, those cities that are dependent on large events and conventions and sporting events, professional sporting events, they really saw a decrease in their business between 60 and 80%.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the fact that we only lost 27% of our business, you know, we're very optimistic about where that leads us for 2021 and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we only lose 27 when others were, you know, losing that much more? I think we touched on that, the big events. But secondly, we have a national park, we're a drive market, and we have small town charm. People were shying away from big cities. They were shying away from big events. And so they wanted to get into some open spaces in small towns where it didn't feel like people were going to be on top of them. And so that's what we did real well last year. That's going to carry over into this year. Layer on top of that, we probably have 75 sporting events that we've booked and continue to be booking. We've got about $3.2 million of business on the books right now today as I sit here with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're going to see that drive market expand. It used to be a couple hundred miles. Now it's about 450. We're going to see the sporting market continue to expand for us because our cities and towns have spent a lot of money investing in infrastructure, and we've invested in the superstructure to sell it. So I feel good about where we are. I feel good that occupancy is going to come back. I think rate will take the other half of the equation. How much room we're charging for it, I think, will lag for a little bit. Number one concern for me is getting people back to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this stimulus money is, you know, I think we've had enough, and it's time for people to get back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
do you think that the situation in Chicago being tighter, for that matter, than here, that might have had an impact, that people still wanted to get out and do things, but they felt they could come across the state line to be able to do it because they couldn't do it in Chicago?
Very much so. I think that, you know, when you look at the states who were very restrictive around us, that drove business to Indiana. I think that as you come out of the pandemic, I think the economy, I mean, what is the number I saw in the newspaper yesterday or the day before, that Illinois passed a $42 billion state budget?
Yeah.
You know, you start doing that with the average homeowner and taxpayer, Indiana is going to continue to look very attractive as a place to live. Our Move to Indiana campaign is going to continue. You know, there's a lot of reasons people are looking at Indiana. And clearly the restrictiveness and I think the financial difficulties that Illinois has makes people take a look at a state that balances its budget, has a surplus, you know, has a little more freedom. I think that makes us look a little more attractive.
And you mentioned earlier about the fact that there's so many more people coming in. They're willing to drive a few hundred miles more to come to Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular than maybe in the past?
Well, as you're taking a look at drive markets and where to drive to,
mm-hmm.
We have a number of interstates that run through the middle of us.
Right.
That 61st National Park, Chris, very big, very big decision maker for people where they say, wow, I didn't know there was a national park there.
Mm-hmm.
We can drive. You know, it just makes a big difference for what they're experiencing. And when they look at what we're made of, when they take a look at communities like Valpo and Crown Point and Whiting, and you know, they take a look at those things and they say, well, that's that small town charm, you know, coupled with Americans right now are looking for small businesses to spend their money at. They want to make those expenditures with women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses. The social consciousness of wanting to spend your money where you think it's going to do better. And we're seeing a lot of those results in the research that's out there. So we've been very fortunate. You know, we've got a great team that understands the product, and we were able to take that product out there rather quickly and tell the story, and I think it's showing dividends today.
Now we're starting summer. Can you give us an idea of, well, besides some of the things you mentioned about sporting events and all that are booked and they'll be going on through the summer, what type of other events are we likely to see come back now because more people are able to get out and do more things, especially this summer?
Well, I think the announcement that Pierogi Fest was returning is a big, you know, probably the big one in the hearts and minds of people in the region. Pierogi Fest is a perennial favorite. The city of Whiting has just, you know, done such a great job. The city looks great. The investments have been smart. The lakefront is attractive, and the reputation of that festival is beyond any. I mean, it's just it's sterling. It is the gold bar of festivals in many ways in this country. It's just it's a well-run, fun festival, and to see that come back says a lot. I think you're already seeing some music festivals announcing their lineups and coming back. I know Mayor Snedecor in Hobart is making a huge announcement for his country music fest.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think those things are all going to do very, very well this year. Americans are fed up. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Right.
They're cooped up, they're fed up, and they want out. And the only problem I see, and it's not even a problem, I think we're going to have to keep an eye on it, is the price of gas. I mean, gas is the highest it's been now in 7 years. I think that we're going to continue to see it inch up, and that's going to be the only thing that might slightly, and I mean ever so slightly, because I think people's cabin fever will outweigh the price of gasoline.
Yeah.
But the price of gas is causing some Americans to reconsider, do I take the trip now, or do I wait a month and see? Because, you know, when you start talking about traveling 500 miles one way, that's a lot of gas.
Yeah.
And, you know, the difference of it being $2 a gallon versus $3.50 a gallon adds up pretty quick. So I'm very excited. I think the live music festivals, Pierogi Fest, our parks being open, the downtowns being walkable and alive, and I just think that it's going to look very normal this summer. Mm-hmm. And I thank God.
Yeah. Now, looking to the future, there's some areas I know that you've talked about in the past and we brought up in our past conversations, things like trying to get a convention center back in operation here in Lake County. I know there are probably some projects like that that are still ongoing. Maybe they've been set aside because of COVID-19, but they're not dead, I would imagine.
Well, we're going to be working with the town of Merrillville. I think they're right now the most, they're the front runner in any convention center possibility. The owner of Century Mall, I've been, you know, working with for 20 years to try to get that project become viable. I think we're going to see some viability to that. I'm hopeful anyway. Mm-hmm. At this point, we're not a major party to the conversation between the landowner and the town of Merrillville, but I think that is the best piece of property where the investment should be made. We're not going to see, I don't believe we're going to see a county council funded project. So the finance is going to be a little more complicated, but it's needed. We need to get a facility back online that's going to bring us the top tier of spending in the hospitality industry, which is the convention delegate and the business transient delegate.
No, not saying bad things about the casinos, and we know that in many cases so far they've been able to try and bring the big acts in because of the fact that we don't have a convention center or a facility like the Star Plaza Theater around any longer. Do you think that that's still going to be a factor to look at here? What do you want to look to bring these the big acts back into Northwest Indiana?
I think the Hard Rock's a game changer.
Yeah.
The Hard Rock is the most important tourism asset to open in 50 years. That facility and what it will do for live entertainment. Currently, because of COVID, the special event space has slot machines in it. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, look forward to the day where those are pulled out and that returns to a special event space, which could then begin to hold some meetings and conferences and, more importantly, live entertainment indoor. Mm-hmm. And with a brand like the Hard Rock, I mean, that is, you know, we've got great brands, obviously the Horseshoe, Ameristar. These are very well-established, nationally recognized companies. When you look at a brand like Hard Rock, which is international, with locations throughout the world, and we have one in our own backyard, I think that signals to people that there's something going on here in the South Shore in Lake County. And I couldn't be more thrilled. I mean, it's a beautiful, if you've not seen it, if your listeners haven't been in, it is a spectacular facility.
Yeah.
It is going to be Matt Schuffert and his management team there are just top shelf operators. You're going to see great things happening at that property, and hopefully it'll be a driver to again lift more excitement in all the gaming product here, because Ameristar's got a beautiful property. Horseshoe, I remember when that that facility was just redone not so long ago. Mm-hmm. I'm very optimistic about what gaming will do and continue to do for the next couple of decades in Lake County.
So it's not going to completely take the place of a convention center, but it's certainly going to fill in as need be.
Well, I think you're going to see some things that are able to be worked into that Hard Rock space.
Yeah.
And I think that'll even be more exciting when a hotel tower is built. And in the meantime, we've got plenty of rooms to fill whatever they want to do there. It's a great location. It's central. It's easily accessible from Chicago. I think meeting planners, when they see that space, because it's a great footprint, are going to very much like it.
So you feel a bit more optimistic now as we speak than maybe you did a year and a half ago or even a year ago. certainly that was when the worst of the pandemic hit us and we were just trying to keep things open or deal with having to be stuck at home.
You know, I, Chris, I've been very, very fortunate in my career here in the region and been able to work on a lot of stuff that really has made a difference for our communities. And you look back at these hiccups in the road, you look back at 9/11. And you can see what it did to travel. And you look back at the recession in 2007, 8, 9, and what it did to the economy. And then you look at this, which was just unprecedented. Never before. I able to teach a course at Purdue Northwest, and I told my students, I said, learn from this. Because you guys lived through it, you're going to have practical experience the next time something completely unforeseen happens. You'll have the ability to draw on this and learn from it. And, you know, our organization, Chris, we did all the right stuff. We cut pay. We had to cut some people. We shut off parts of the building. I mean, you name it, we cut it in order to weather the storm, and we did. And we're here stronger, leaner. And, you know, the proof is we only lost 27% of the business. We have a team that was very dedicated to helping the small businesses here. We were on the phones with restaurants, helping them interface with hospitals to get the frontline medical people fed. We were working with, I remember Rick Bella from the town of Merrillville called me and said, hey, we're looking at putting up firemen and firefighters in secure areas and hotels so they don't get exposed. You know, we did a 180-degree pivot inward to our community like every CVB did in America, and we developed closer relationships. I think people understood the value of tourism now more than ever. When you can't go to your favorite restaurant and you can't travel and you can't go visit, you know, your family in whatever city, it was painful, but it was also eye-opening for the community we serve to place a new value on those jobs, those businesses, and that economy. And that's the silver lining I take away from COVID.
Spiros Botostatos, thanks for spending time with us to talk about it.
Chris, it's a great pleasure to see you, my friend, anytime. You know that.
That's South Shore CVA President Spiros Botostatos. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Beginning this summer, Franciscan Health will begin implementing a plan to downsize the historic former St. Catherine's Hospital in Hammond into a more streamlined healthcare facility. The president and CEO of Franciscan Health, Dyer Munster Hammond, Patrick Maloney, and the chairman of the Regional Board of Trustees, Cal Bellamy, were on Regionally Speaking recently to talk about it.
Well, we have historically been seeing our volumes getting smaller and smaller on the inpatient side, and that's a national trend for acute care, as well as taking care of these very aged buildings we have on our Hammond campus. And so last year, we actually asked for a comprehensive study of our facility's infrastructure. When the estimate came back, they said to keep this building viable for the next 10 or so years, it was going to require an investment of about $80 million. And that's just for boilers, air handlers, generators. That has nothing to do with clinical care. And at the time, we were at the height of COVID, we were losing upwards of $20 million a month in my division. And so when my CFO did a projection for the year, it looked like we were on a pace to lose $78 million. And at that point, we knew something had to change.
Mm-hmm.
So we contracted with Kaufman Hall, a national healthcare consulting firm. And they did a comprehensive study of the region, of the trends, where inpatient is going, And they looked at the capacity, and then they looked at our building, which we were probably only utilizing 30 to 40% of this building. And their recommendation was to cease all acute care operations here at Hammond. They felt that there's enough capacity in the region, and as more and more patients are being treated on an outpatient basis, they didn't feel this building was necessary. So at that point, we went to our board, both locally and at the corporate level, and we didn't want to leave the city. We knew that it would be perceived that we were abandoning this area, and that is not what we wanted to do. So I'll allow my chairperson, Mr. Cal Bellamy, to talk about what the board agreed to.
Okay, Cal, go ahead.
All right. Well, Patrick described some of the more recent studies. Actually, the Hammond campus has been under review for about 3 years because, you know, you have to have all three factors to have a successful operation. You have to have great patient care, you have to have employee opportunity, and you have to have financial sustainability. Without any one of those, there are none. The other two fail. So with the financial situation in Hammond, we had no alternative to do something. And the question was, what would we do? And so there were various alternatives and discussions. Do we spend a couple hundred million dollars and keep the facility as it is, but upgraded? Do we go to a mini hospital, which would have been about $80 million? Or do we drop down to the current proposal, which is still going to be about $45 million? So I don't want to sound like it's all dollars and cents, but the board has to balance financial sustainability. Otherwise, we don't have quality patient care. We don't have employee opportunities. So this was a difficult decision. I have three generations in my family of history with the Hammond campus. I helped raise funds for the building that we're going to be tearing down. So it's an emotional decision for me, too. But it has to be a decision made so that we can continue to serve our patients. And Patrick alluded to the fact that patients are coming less frequently to the hospital. The way medicine is going, hospital stays are very short now. And we're making a significant commitment to another type service, telemedicine, so that we can handle patients remotely in many cases. And again, that will affect hospitalization. So if we don't do something, we jeopardize everything. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of thinking that the board went through. As I say, many discussions, many regular board meetings and special board meetings over an extended period of time, trying to find some way to maximize the use of the Hammond campus.
We know that so far there's been a lot of comment, a lot of people that are lamenting what's going to happen to the old hospital in Hammond. I know some have said in a way that they see it kind of following along the same lines as what happened to Goldblatt's and Minas and the Hammond Times building and a lot of other structures in that particular region of historic downtown Hammond that will be, at least in this particular case, downsized, but still not going away, but still not the same as it was. And there are a lot of people who remember, and Cal, you mentioned this too at the first of our conversation about the fact that you have generations of family members that that have had some participation with the hospital, children born there, family members that have passed on there perhaps. But the idea is that there's a lot of history and a lot of sentiment in the old facility. It's going to be tough, I would imagine, to be able to move ahead out of all that, won't it?
Yes, and we're sensitive to the sentimental attachment people have to the Hammond campus, but unfortunately, they're all speaking in the past tense. They're not describing coming to the campus now. And so a hospital campus can't be a historical object. It has to be a vibrant, working entity. And if people have fond memories but aren't coming there anymore, that doesn't help a whole lot. So I think you have to keep that in perspective. Now, so far as downtown Hammond is concerned, the sisters completely support Mayor McDermott's efforts to revitalize the downtown area,
mm-hmm.
and we are active participants in that. We have a large parking lot across Holman Avenue, the east side of Holman Avenue, very close to where the new South Shore station is going to be. We'll have land available on our present campus site that will be cleared, and all that land, we will be active participants in trying to get that developed and promoted to restore the vitality of downtown Hammond. Not that it'll be like it was, not a big retail center. The mayor has very nice plans, and as I say, we're anxious to participate.
The Hammond project is tentatively scheduled to begin in August. The Indiana Secretary of Career Connections and Talent will step down from her role this week on June 7th, to be exact. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports it comes after her department was absorbed several months ago by the Indiana Economic Development Corporation.
Blair Milo is the state's first and so far only Career Connections and Talent Secretary. Governor Eric Holcomb appointed her to the newly created role in 2017, for which she resigned in the middle of her second term as mayor of LaPorte. Milo spearheaded the 21st Century Talent Region program, designed to help public and private agencies align their goals around workforce development. The 12 designated regions focused on metrics like population growth and getting more students to get some career education after high school. Milo is resigning to launch a private program to help women and other underrepresented groups become entrepreneurs. The governor's office has not decided if it will nominate a new person to the role or eliminate it entirely. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy is with us to bring us up to date on what's happening in the community these days. And first off, thanks for joining us on the program today, sir.
Hey, great to be on, Chris. How you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I know that that Valparaiso, along with many other communities across Indiana and Northwest Indiana, are getting ready to take in the funds that is coming from the American Rescue Plan is coming out of Washington and being handed out to states across the nation. And I know that you and your members of the city council are getting together. And in fact, there's an ordinance that's now for further reading at the future city council meetings as to what is coming in from the state and from the current nation. What plans does the city of Valparaiso have to be able to use the federal funds that are going to be available and the city council gets to administer?
Sure. The indications we've received from the federal government through Congressman Mervan's office is that Valparaiso is set to receive about $7 million in two tranches this year and next year, so mm-hmm. probably half this year and half next year. We have not received any of those funds yet, and we're still defining how the funds can be used according to all the rules and regulations coming out of Indianapolis and really Washington, D.C., and we'll be developing a plan now so that we can use the funds effectively on Valpo priorities, but it's a little premature to outline a plan right now.
Yeah, that's part of the plan that you're going through now is looking at what you have to work with in general, and I'm sure priorities are going to be in line. Have you had a chance to talk with city council members about what you'd like to be able to use the money for?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, but it's unclear what the rules are. So once we have a good understanding of what exactly, it seems that the guidance we're getting right now is very broad, but we want to make sure that we're staying within the rules and regulations of all that before we come out with a plan. So we'll be engaging the council short order.
Yeah, I guess that what is up, I guess, within the ordinance, if you have to have, obviously, a fund to be able to establish where the money is going to go, and you haven't had an opportunity at least to talk not only with the council, but with residents as to, within the guidelines, what you'd like to use the money for?
Yeah, so the first thing the council had to do is create a fund so that when we receive the money, we can put that those dollars into the appropriate fund. And ultimately, we have to present, the city administration has to present a plan for those funds to the council, which then they will approve and appropriate. And again, we're in the very beginning phases. I've talked to a lot of people about ideas and thoughts, and there's a wide variety of ideas floating around, a lot of good ones, a lot of bad ones. And my goal, you know, as mayor is, I look back when Mayor Costas received major moves money from the state of Indiana. It was sort of a windfall we hadn't planned on. And, you know, I remember those funds were used for really transformative projects in our community that will last many multiple generations. So that's about all I can tell you right now, that the mindset that I have for those dollars. I want to do the same thing,
mm-hmm.
be wise with them, use them very wisely, make wise investments with them, and protect every dollar that we can. And really, the goal is that it's going to be, you know, whatever we invest in will be around for multiple generations for our community to enjoy.
Going back to the major moves money that you had an opportunity as a member of the staff at the city of Valparaiso to work with, what did you were able to do with the funds back then? Obviously, there will probably be similar guidelines if you haven't gotten official word on yet what at least the latest money when the American Rescue Plan is going to dole out. What did you have get chance to do back then with the major moves money?
Well, you know, Chris, a big chunk of the major moves money was allocated towards our Central Park Plaza in downtown Valpo, which is our most popular park in the city. We have 19 parks. It's the most popular park in Valparaiso. And that was obviously a really wise investment for the city. And a lot of other, there were some stormwater projects. There, some pathways, things that they're still around today that you can point at and say that was major moves money, you know, that we invested in, and we can still enjoy it. And but a big chunk of the major moves money that the city received went into investing in Central Park Plaza, the acquisition, the construction. It was a very expensive endeavor, but we did it, and we didn't hand a bill to the next generation. It was paid for, didn't borrow any money, and was done done very prudently on a financial matter.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy about what's happening in the city these days. We have mentioned that the city council and the administration will be getting to work with allocations from the American Rescue Plan. That's in the works right now. What are some of the other projects that are underway, certainly with road projects and the like, that is happening in the city of Valparaiso these days?
Yeah, you know, we have just we've been so blessed with the progress in paving in Valparaiso. Again, you know, we're looking forward to another productive year in roadway projects. Last year, in the first year of my new administration, even during the pandemic, we were able to pave a record number of miles, about 12 miles. This year, we're off again on the right foot. We won a $1 million community crossing grant from NDOT. This grant will help us improve roads very well traveled in Valparaiso, including big sections of Morgan, Calumet, and Roosevelt Road. Right now, there are several roadway projects underway in the city. Work we're doing over on Eisenhower. This project was initiated by neighbors. They approached the city with really a problem that had been neglected for many years, and it was time to tackle it. So we submitted that for a grant, which happened, and then we added some city funds to it. So neighbors are looking forward to paving curbs, new sidewalks where none existed before, plus underground utility improvements. My goal is to be over on Eisenhower Avenue for trick-or-treat night, because those folks in that neighborhood have not had sidewalks, so they're really excited about that. We're looking forward to another busy paving year in Valpo.
I know that your administration has been working with other groups in Valparaiso to address the issue of affordable housing. It's an issue that every community really has, but it's been, I know, one big project that has been going on for decades, it seems, with administrations, with the Costas administration before you, and now you're getting to deal with it. What's the latest that you're bringing up here with your staff on the issue of affordable housing?
Yeah, we recently released a comprehensive residential market study that shares current inventories and emerging priorities in housing. We've shared this with the community to many stakeholders throughout, including developers and residents and folks in the affordable housing sector, and we will continue to weigh projects based on this data. The city decided to partner with the Uptown partners to do a workforce housing project at the old Uptown apartments. With the closure of the law school, we have two empty buildings, and the plan was to put about 112 workforce housing units there. That's delayed a little bit. There's a lawsuit with the university that we're working through, but we're hopeful we can work that out and get that project going as well. So, yeah, it's something that is it affects every community, and in Valparaiso, we're tackling it best we can. And the most important thing that we're trying to do is do what we always done in Valpo, and that's have a balanced housing approach. And we can't get too out of whack in one way or the other. We can't have too much high end or too much low end. It's got to be a blend, and that's, I think, one of the strengths of our community is you can go from very affordable up to some really what I would consider extremely unaffordable houses in Valparaiso, and we've got everything in between. And to me, that's one of our strengths, is we've got something for everybody, and we're really proud of that. So we're going to continue to focus on having a balanced housing approach to our city.
One of the other areas I know that you have worked in, certainly in the past because you've been economic development director in the city of Valparaiso, is bringing new businesses to the city. There are projects that are underway right now. Of course, the expansion and the renovation in the old ANCO site that is not only going along with expanding business, but the city transit system. What's the latest in getting the Journeyman Brewery up and running and getting that business opened up soon?
Sure, that's a major project and a transformative project for the city, and we've been working with the potential developers of that, obviously Journeyman Distillery, now for months to tackle all the issues, and I think we're getting really, really close to coming to an agreement on how that whole program will work in terms of the city and what we're going to provide and what the private sector will provide. So we're close, and I can tell you it's going to be an amazing project. It's really a destination, and I think it's a game changer for the city of Valparaiso. So I think we're getting close. We're tackling a lot of different issues. As you know, that's a 70,000 square foot, really, very old building with a lot of issues, and the substantial investment. And so we've got a lot of things to work through. But we're getting close, and we've also Amazon's new delivery station in Valparaiso, that's opening. We're excited about that. St. Mary Medical Center is working on a third floor expansion of their Valparaiso campus, which we're really excited about. And we also recently announced a plan to break ground. Sold some property to Ecos Window and Wall, a state-of-the-art factory to manufacture glass curtain walls in Valparaiso. And hopefully that announcement will be soon groundbreaking. So together, these businesses alone represent more than $40 million in investment, plus more than 400 new jobs. That doesn't include the Journeyman investment. We're not quite sure exactly what that investment is going to be, but it's going to be upwards of $30 million in private and $15 million in public. So there's some big projects going on we're excited about, and we want to keep the pedal to the metal.
Mm-hmm. I know this is the only big problem I know is trying to deal with these projects and the developers having to deal with their own individual issues with the pandemic still at large. And it's part of the things you have to fit in together as a mayor and the administration has to deal with, right?
Absolutely. And we're here to support our businesses. They did a great job during the pandemic. And, we really value the Valpo businesses, and we saw how hard they worked. And we were actually one of the few communities to apply for and win grant funds to help qualifying businesses retain jobs. We're calling this grant the Valpo Invest in Business, or VIB grant. We expect to be able to distribute up to a about $10,000 per qualifying business. We're still getting the guidelines from the Indiana Office of Community and Rural Affairs, or OCRA, who awarded the grant to the city. We invite businesses to sign up for the information as we receive it. Businesses can learn more on our website at valpo.us by visiting the economic development page, again, valpo.us. And so check that out. We're really excited about that grant. We received $250,000 from OCRA. So we're excited about that. We want to get those dollars in the hands of these businesses that qualify.
Finally, Mayor Murphy, I know that there's been some good news lately that's come out with trying to help neighbors. Neighbors trying to help neighbors in getting their homes renovated. Many people have had problems trying to get caught up with the repairs at their house, and city members and as well as neighbors have been able to get together and get their neighbors dealing with these issues, taking care of the home care program in particular is one big program that's gotten some attention lately, I understand.
Yeah, you know, Home Team Valpo has just been a great initiative. It's something that I advanced during my campaign, and we acted on it in my first months, even during the pandemic. I saw it as a priority, and we were pleased to make it happen. Home Team Valpo is a nonprofit supported by the city of Valparaiso in priority, manpower, and funding, designed to, as you said, help Valpo homeowners make their homes safer, more accessible, more efficient, and more comfortable, and this helps neighborhoods, one house at a time. We've helped dozens of homeowners and united hundreds of volunteers for Home Team Valpo this past year. We're really happy with bringing people together and seeing all ages benefit. We've had many Valpo students help, and that's been really great to see. If folks want to learn more about how they can get involved in Home Team Valpo, they have a website. It's hometeamvalpo.org. Check it out.
Well, Mayor Murphy, thank you for spending time with us here on Originally Speaking to talk about what's been happening in the city of Valpo and all the other projects as well, too, and hope to have a chance to get you back on again to talk soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Matt Murphy's the mayor of Valparaiso. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There is a new statewide initiative from Indiana Humanities that is going to encourage Hoosiers, including those here in Northwest Indiana, to discover and talk about their relationships with the natural world. The initiative is called Unearthed. Let's find out more about it from the lady who is supervising the whole statewide project. Megan Telligman is a senior program manager with Indiana Humanities, and she's based out of Indianapolis. And Megan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Give us some of the thoughts that you all at Indiana Humanities had in creating Unearthed. And I know a lot of it came because of all of us trying to finally get our way out of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think we noted through the past 18 months that Hoosiers, you know, have always had a special relationship to our local environments, but definitely during the pandemic, they became a place of refuge and relief. When we couldn't be inside together, we could at least be outdoors a little more safely. So I think that brought a renewed attention to Indiana's parks and natural spaces, and we think a lot about our relationship to the environment at Indiana Humanities throughout our programming, so we're just doing a deeper dive with this new theme.
That's interesting. I know that, of course, we've carried some of these various topics before from Indiana Humanities, the projects like Inseparable and Quantum Leap and some other great programs as well, too. So they fit well with the humanities disciplines as well as life in the real world, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The humanities are a vast thing, you know, literature, philosophy, ethics, history. So really try to focus our work around these topics that feel relevant to Hoosiers today, and use the humanities as an entry point to talk about some big ideas.
And I know that there is a wealth of topics as well as activities and events that are going to happen while the Unearthed initiative is underway. Will you give us a look at some of the statewide ones that even people in Northwest Indiana can take a look at in particular, maybe participate in, and certainly ones here in Northwest Indiana that they may be definitely interested in?
There are always programs that are for everybody in the state. So we have a lot of participants up in Northwest Indiana in our One State, One Story program and some of the others. We partner with libraries and schools statewide to host some programs that are on the theme. But we have some things coming up immediately that are very exciting. So the first thing that's kicking off at the end of this month is a tour of the Smithsonian's Waterway Exhibition. And so we partner with the Smithsonian to bring this really wonderful traveling exhibit in that talks about America's relationship with water. And six sites in Indiana will host that exhibit for 6 weeks each. And one of those sites is the LaPorte Public Library in Rolling Prairie.
Mm-hmm.
They will have the exhibit from August 14th to September 26th of 2021. And so that's coming very soon. And it's a way that Northwest Indiana Hoosiers can come together and gather and talk about relationship to Lake Michigan, but also the watershed there. And the LaPorte County Public Library will be creating their own partner exhibit that talks about local issues.
That's great to hear.
So we're very excited that will be opening at the end of this month.
That's great. I understand there's a webinar coming up, I guess, before that on June 30th that will get everybody involved, I guess, around the state, including here in the region, as to the Unearthed theme. Will you tell us a little about that?
June 30th, we try to kick things off with a little info session. These themes last several years, so there's a lot of room for different programs to come along over time. So we like to start our themes with a conversation where we can kind of overview what to expect and how people can get involved. Another thing that folks can do right now is nonprofits in the state can apply to host a talk for free from our Speakers Bureau. So during that webinar, we'll go over the details of that and highlight some of the speakers that are available, and also talk about the Waterways Exhibition and then some of the other exciting programs we have coming later this year.
That's great to hear. Besides the Smithsonian Waterways Exhibit that you mentioned is out there, there's also one for people can take part in, enjoy, and certainly the ones that LaPorte County can take a look at. There's also a 90-second video that certainly mm-hmm. is geared to the arts, and in particular to poetry and to writers. Will you tell us about that, please?
As a kind of introduction to this theme, we were lucky enough to have poet Ross Gay and environmental theorist and writer Scott Russell Sanders do a little intro for us. So Ross kicks it off with a poem, and then Scott talks a little bit about how the humanities, he has this beautiful line, they're a reservoir of humans' kind of experience and kind of catalog our historical understandings and relationships with the natural world. So it's a little 90-second clip that gets us kind of thinking about why these matters are so important, especially as we look at environmental change that we're witnessing now.
We're talking with Megan Teligman, who is with Indiana Humanities, about the new Indiana Humanities multi-year thematic initiative, which is called Unearthed. And I guess that implies that it isn't just a summertime or a warm weather event or a series of events. I understand there's even going to be one that might involve some of the cold weather months, in particular a campfire. Can you tell us mm-hmm. what that's all about?
Our campfire series is a long-running program of ours.
Mm-hmm.
That we're hoping to expand through the next several years. So basically, campfires, we pair a humanities scholar, like an English professor or a historian, with a naturalist, and we go on a hike. And along the way, we may pause and read some literature, read a poem, talk and reflect on that, and then continue on our hike. We call them trek and talks.
That sounds interesting.
And so we do. Yeah, they're very fun. So we do have some that happen in the fall. And then we've, due to COVID, we introduced some virtual campfires so that we can do things in the winter months without experiencing so much of the weather.
Well, it's too bad that they can't all be virtual, because you can't enjoy s'mores unless you have a real yeah. campfire. And that's what you kind of look forward to when you have a campfire, getting together and talking and having fun that way, too. Is there a particular website that with Indiana Humanities people can go to and find out more about the Unearthed Initiative and the programs?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go to indianahumanities.org. And it's right, Unearthed is right there on the homepage, mm-hmm. or you can go to indianahumanities.org/unearthed and find everything there.
That's great. Thank you, Megan, for all the information, and the best of luck in the Unearthed initiative that's getting underway very soon here in Indiana, in particular here in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Chris.
You're welcome. Megan Teligman is with Indiana Humanities. Indiana Humanities connects people and opens minds and enriches lives by creating and facilitating programs that encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with the new owner and publisher of the Chesterton Tribune, Don Hurd. We hope you can join us.